Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed and the Unrestricted Area podcast on the Basketball Intelligence Network. We're doing yet another crossover episode. I am one of your hosts for the day, Nick Agar-Johnson, representing the No Ceilings side of the equation. And I'm here today with two of Basketball Intelligence's finest, Aaron Bullwinkle and my Kings Weekly podcast co-host, Ray LeBeau. Aaron, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself, Nick?
I'm doing great. It's been just long enough that I could get some sleep for the first time in weeks after the draft. So, you know, I think I have a slightly better perspective on it with more than, you know, 25 minutes of sleep during the week. So I'm doing great. It's, you know, it's always fun to talk draft for me. And I haven't gotten a chance to talk draft with you, Aaron, in a long time. And Ray, let's throw to you. Obviously, I've gotten to talk draft with you quite a bit more recently, but happy to do it again. How are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing well. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for joining us. Let's start off. And by the way, this is a very great treat for me because I get to host the show with two of my favorite experts on the draft. Not one of my strong points because I don't really have the opportunity, unless I were to clone myself, to do much scouting of potential draftees during the season. So it's great to have Nick and Aaron provide us their expertise about the draft. So let's start with asking each of you to sort of share your first impressions of what happened in the draft. And let me say one other thing, which is that obviously free agency period has started and there's been some signings. And yes, of course, we're aware of those, but we really want to focus on the draft. And if we were to get the draft as impacted by free agency, we might never finish. And so let's just focus specifically on the draft to the extent that we can. So start with you, Nick.
So my first impression, I think, was this has been a trend for quite a while, so it's not particularly a surprise, but it is a bit shocking to me just how thoroughly youth focused the draft has become. I mean, there was one upperclassman drafted in the lottery. He's a sophomore. Or no, I'm sorry. There were two upperclassmen drafted in the lottery. One of them a sophomore and one of them an up transfer who has had an incredible story in Cedric Coward. But I mean, again, just it's not new, but it did sort of impress itself on me the extent to which teams are sort of betting entirely on what players are going to become rather than what players already are.
I think to Nick's point too, it's interesting. Obviously this draft set a record for most freshmen taken in the first round at 18. And I think it kind of reflects, again, we're not going to get too much into any of the free agency or any of that, but the realities of teams wanting player control on very favorable contracts with these younger players because of now the issues with the salary cap and the second apron feeling like a hard cap. And I think we're directly seeing that play itself out in how they're going back to this really young kind of look at evaluating players and seeing if they can get them at this period, get them into their organization and their developmental system as quickly as possible so they can capitalize hopefully on these guys being viable options in their second, third years, cheaper contracts.
That's a great point regarding the CBA because we've obviously been involved in a lot of conversations about the impact that the second apron and other aspects of the CBA have had generally across the association. And it's really good to, you know, add to that conversation because we haven't heard that much about the point that you just made about how it really impacted the draft specifically rather than, you know, restrictions on trades and those sorts of things. Another thing that was very prominent in this draft was NIL. NIL in terms of how it affected players both internationally and domestically regarding their decision about whether to enter and stay in the draft or not. And Nick, why don't you walk us through that?
Yeah, so it's not like the NIL discussion phenomenon is particularly, I mean, it's new-ish at this point, but what I think to me felt newer rather than new-ish was the notion of all the international players who, rather than, you know, sticking around on their NBL teams or, you know, their Spanish league teams or, you know, whatever team they happen to play on, just how many international players withdrew from this draft to accept NIL deals with American colleges. I mean, Ben Henschel to me was sort of the turning point for me in my mind of that was someone who, you know, depending on where you looked, was mid to late second round, probably had a chance at being drafted earlier, you know, depending on how workouts went, et cetera, et cetera. And yet there wasn't even sort of a discussion of it. It was, oh, so he's going to be going to Florida. That's a bit new. I mean, for me, I think really the moment where this first sort of reared its head in my mind was when Kasper Siakoshonis signed with Illinois. That was sort of the moment for me of, oh, so it's really just going to be college as essentially a farm league for the NBA rather than, you know, name your international league having players who, you know, either are from that country or are from relatively nearby, or even just, I mean, you know, going back to Emmanuel Mudiay, guys have been going over to try and start their professional career a year earlier than they could be drafted. For me, it's fascinating to sort of see the reverse. And it's not as much the reverse because the NCAA has been forced to do away with the farce that they weren't a professional league. So, you know, that I think does make it a little bit less odd, but it did strike me just how many strong international prospects, instead of entering the draft, probably going somewhere in the, you know, early to mid second round being a stash, they're saying, no, I'm not going to be a stash. I'm going to go play for the Florida Gators.
Well, Nick, I think that if I understood your last point correctly, I think the difference is one of magnitude.
Sure.
You know, back prior to the new arrangement that was, you know, forced by the Supreme Court, yes, the top players were getting a lot of money, but a lot of money is one thing. A lot of money x 100 is a lot different. And also now it's out in the open.
Yeah.
You know, we'll wait and see whether out in the open means that even though it's a lot more money, whether the cheating that went on before now just takes place at a higher level over the cap. Who knows?
I mean, it's really hard to fit $6 million into a duffel bag, you know? So.
but the answer inevitably, because on a continuous timeline, people are always going to find the way to try to gain the competitive advantage that is circumventing the rules is, yes, the cheating is going to continue. It's just going to morph into something different. Maybe it's land deals or whatever else they can figure out. But the reality is that that's going to be a part of it. Now, to pull the thread a little bit more in terms of what Nick's talking about, just kind of the greater conversation about the NIL, there's really kind of an oversized impact. We look at the fact that the G League Unite is disbanded, right? And to your point, Nick, these alternative avenues for certain players are now being kind of pulled back in and reined back in. And we're seeing players now kind of go back to the college route, which was the whole intention for the colleges in the first place, as they watch these prospects go overseas for just 1 year. Now they're more comfortable with them just going back to the schools for 1 year. And then it's also interesting how it affects some of the upperclassmen who would have been guys. A Coleman Hawkins comes to mind, who would have been a guy who would have been probably a late second round pick. He ends up going back because he's going to get a big payday. And we're seeing that a little bit more now with guys who are fourth or fifth year guys as well.
Coleman Hawkins is an interesting one to bring up. Obviously, Sacramento native, someone who I liked a lot more in last year's draft than this year's draft because he did not have the best season, but he did at least make a lot of money. So that's great for him. And I mean that genuinely. I think for me, it's more that the route, it's not just that the G League Ignite route is gone. It's not just that the Overtime Elite League has essentially become a high school league after, you know, being a pathway that at least a couple people, you know, especially the Thompson twins in particular standing out, you know, at least a couple people followed that path to the NBA. For me, it's really more the sort of influx of, you know, players who probably would have been, you know, signing for Real Madrid, who instead are saying, you know, I'm going to go the U.S. college route because, you know, the Emmanuel Mudiays of the world, that almost feels more like a fad at this point of like, okay, a few guys did that. Emmanuel Mudiay did it. LaMelo Ball did it. Right. And now it's like, the American players are just going to go to American colleges at this point because they're getting paid more and they're closer to home, right? For me, it's more the international guys saying, no, I'm actually, and again, I mean, Kaspers Jokisonis stood out to me in this class. Ben Henschel also stood out to me, you know, in a similar manner of, you know, he could have stuck around in the NBL, right? And instead, it's like, I'm going to get the NIL money from Florida. He could have entered the NBA draft. I mean, he was, you know, he withdrew, right? He was in the NBA draft and then decided, no, I'm going to take the bag at Florida. And Florida specifically, you know, there's been plenty of buzz that he went to Florida because he's really good friends with Alex Condon, who's someone else who did a similar thing, who I, you know, thought had a chance at being a late first round pick, instead decided to go back to college for yet another year because he's getting paid there. You know, the American players going back to sort of having college be the feeder system for the NBA, that is not, it doesn't feel abnormal to me in the way that the influx of international players taking NIL money rather than professional money overseas, that feels more new to me.
Okay, so I'd like to shift our focus to some of the top storylines. I have one in mind, and then we can branch out from there. First one I'd like to hear your thoughts on is, we all have heard from time immemorial that, quote, it's a copycat league. And we've seen various ways that that seems to be true over the years. And, you know, some of them are very obvious. The one that I'm interested in relative to the draft is, what are your thoughts regarding the Thunder and the Pacers and the way their teams were constructed and used? Did that have any discernible impact on any specific situation that you noticed during the draft?
I think that the notion of the copycat league makes the draft for the Brooklyn Nets make a lot more sense, if you think about it that way, in the sense of, you know, oh, this team drafted five first round picks, which no team had ever held on to five first round picks. And every single one, well, no, four of the five players they took are players who have been at their best and have played most of their, you know, lifetimes with the ball in their hands. Right. And so I think that to me really stands out as a copycat notion of, oh, we just saw Indiana and Oklahoma City, you know, just run out lineup after lineup after lineup after lineup where there was no one on the floor who you didn't trust to some extent with the ball in their hands. Now, obviously you trusted Tyrese Haliburton and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander with the ball in their hands more than Aaron Wiggins and Andrew Nembhard. But, you know, I think that notion really makes the Brooklyn draft make a lot more sense of, rather than, you know, try and construct a lineup where everybody has a more traditional role, they just want to throw out lineups where, you know, especially with Yegor Demon and Danny Wolf, we have enough size to potentially make things work defensively. And it's just a matter of, we want everybody on this floor at any given time to be able to attack the basket with the ball in their hands.
Kind of to that point as well, I think one of the things that the Thunder and Pacers were really at the kind of leading or in the forefront of in terms of how they've developed their organizations is they decided an identity that they wanted to have their teams kind of be the underpinning of how they focus, you know, Thunder being long defensive oriented, the Pacers having guys that really move the ball and willing to buy in defensively. And I think you can look at the Hornets and their draft, and I think it's starting to feel like they're an organization that may be doing that as well. Like they, it seems like they're identifying, look, we have players in general who don't necessarily bring the most locked in mentality, and they're bringing in guys in this draft that are very much the opposite of that. I mean, I think all four guys, when you look at Knupel, McNeely, Sion James, and Kalkbrenner, are guys that you really rely on to be intelligent, tough-minded players who are definitely team-oriented. And I think that's really a reflection of exactly what the Thunder and Pacers have done. I'm not saying the Hornets were necessarily exactly trying to do the copycat thing, but it is very similar in that vein and in that asset play as well. They drafted guys that make sense. They drafted guys that work for them. And I think also guys that kind of fit a general kind of construct.
And look, I don't mean to bag on them too much because, as I noted up top, Ray and I are the hosts of a podcast about a team, namely the Sacramento Kings, that doesn't exactly have the best history of this either. But the Hornets draft stood out to me in particular because they have not made sense for so many years that, oh, there appears to be a defining philosophy now that there really wasn't before of, you know, what you mentioned, you know, not only getting guys who have a veteran mindset, even if they're younger players, but also, you know, it's interesting. Everybody that they drafted had played with, you know, players who were considered, well, depends on how you feel about the UConn team around McNeely, but really with Knipple, he was not the best player on his own team. With Kalkbrenner, I mean, he played with Trey Alexander in Ryan Kalkbrenner's case, and obviously Sion James played with Cooper Flagg and Connor Knipple at Duke. It's interesting to me because the Hornets have felt so listless for a while that they, in this draft, had a very clearly identified plan that they stuck to.
Yeah, and to your point with McNeely, sure, in college, no, but Montverde, that's absolutely exact same case. So it does for still sure. fit within that kind of that general theme.
Yeah, no, completely agree. Great point there.
Let's staying in sort of the general rubric of top storylines of the draft. What are some of those that were particularly noticeable to you? And either one of you can start with that.
I'll jump off. I mean, it's obviously like I don't need to start with the negative, but we've all kind of heard it ad nauseum. I was kind of sticker shock at the moment with what the Pelicans were doing. It's hard not to just get fixed. Separate of the trade, which, of course, trading an unrestricted draft pick to move from 23 to 13 just makes absolutely no sense when you're talking about a 2026 draft that people really are high on. And when you look at this Pelicans roster, I don't see any means by which they become a competitive team. But I'm also just the fit where the players are concerned is crazy to me. You bring in Jeremiah Fears. Now you have a glut at guard. Where with Jordan Poole and eventually DeJounte Murray coming back, and Poole and Murray probably being difficult assets to move. And then in Derek Queen, you bring in a player who the biggest issue was his conditioning and kind of his ability to lock in on that. You bring him into New Orleans, which as a city in the first place, you gain 5 pounds as soon as you step off a flight. But then you match him up with Zion Williamson, who does not have the best reputation where that's concerned. And then the on-court fit, two bigs who can't defend and can't shoot with another guard who can't shoot. It's just, it's really hard to figure out what they were doing. I mean, the pick in the second round makes sense because PV can shoot. But in general, I just don't know what the construct is here at all or what the sensibility of what they're trying to do is.
I'm torn because Derek Queen was one of my favorite prospects in this draft. And so, you know, picking him up in a vacuum is something that I would be very excited about if I were running an NBA front office. I had him quite a bit higher on my personal board than 13th. So, you know, in that vacuum, yeah, I would have loved it if, you know, Derek Queen was the player that they took and that they didn't make that trade. But, you know, it was very interesting to me. And by interesting, I mean incredibly upsetting from the New Orleans perspective when, you know, after the aftermath of that, of, wow, I don't entirely get the trade, but Derek Queen was a prospect that I loved, so I guess I'm kind of iffy but not entirely out on this. And then the day after the draft, we at No Ceilings did our 2026 mock draft, way too early mock draft, which, you know, got the internet up in a frenzy because anytime people can argue about anything on the internet, they're going to argue about it on the internet. But, you know, when I was putting that together, I realized, oh, you know, because we just did the mock draft in the order, like reverse standings order, rather than trying to, you know, do a lottery sim or anything like that. And it's like, oh, so the pick that would be going to Atlanta as a result of this trade was the fourth pick in the 2026 draft. So I was like, you know, I would have loved Derek Queen in pretty much any other situation with pretty much any other trade. And I think I higher on his defense than you are, Aaron, just because I think he's got exceptional hands and I think that will really help out. But he's someone who needs a good defensive center alongside him to make things work, or, you know, a really stretchy power forward who can allow him to, you know, sit in the paint, play safety, essentially pick off passes, you know, rip guys, and then have a shot blocking flexible four alongside him. That's not what he's getting in New Orleans. And I was not as high on Jeremiah Fears as clearly the Pelicans were, given that he was the seventh overall pick. So, you know, from both of those perspectives, it just feels incredibly confusing that they acted the way that they did. And, you know, who knows? Maybe my belief in Derek Queen and his own ability makes that work out to some extent. But really, any other situation where Derek Queen was going to go, I was going to be much higher on all of it. And instead, it just feels weird. And I don't know. I mean, that pick next year could be even more of a killer than it seems like it is right now. And even looking at it right now, it seems like short-sighted, I think, is generous.
Yeah, and just like, I'm not as high on Queen as a lot of people, but I'm siloing my own opinion. Even if Derek Queen ends up awesome, this is just from a straight asset play. It's just a very difficult trade to justify without at least putting some type of protection on the pick. It's just it doesn't make sense to me there from that standpoint. And that's kind of the biggest thing here for me, is just kind of like, a if we flatten out everything and you just look at it, it doesn't even it. But obviously they love Queen, so maybe they feel like they get their guy and whatever. But it was hard to stomach and fathom. And I can't separate myself and go, now I get it. Like, a week later, I'm still feeling the same way.
Yeah, honestly, if they had just taken Queen at 7 and sat out the rest of the draft, I'd feel a lot better about it.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about some of the other storylines, Nick.
Yeah. We haven't touched on what was, I think, to pretty much everybody, the most surprising moment of the night, which was Portland taking Jan Hansen at 16. And I don't think there's a very large number of scouts who have seen him play live. I saw him play live at Sacramento Summer League last year, which offensively, I think, was a good sign of seeing him live. Defensively, there was a very clear sort of notion that he is not going to be challenging anything around the basket that might end up in him getting injured. So, you know, I wasn't really sold on any part of the defensive evaluation. Offensively, there are only so many human beings on this earth who are 7'2", 260 pounds, and as fluid as he is with the ball in his hands, whether that be his post game, which is exceptional. I don't know how valuable that is in this version of the NBA, but he does have a truly preternatural feel in the post, and his passing for his position is also exceptional. He did quite a bit better in most of the athletic tests at the combine than I was expecting after having seen him moving around live. But the part that he did not do well at in the combine was the part that concerned me the most, you know, watching his film and then watching him in person, which is he does not move laterally very well, which, you know, if he's directly underneath the basket, he's going to be a rim protection threat just purely on the basis of his size. And, you know, he does foul a decent amount. I do like his shot blocking instincts, generally speaking, but unless he's stationed under the basket, he's not someone who's going to be cutting off drives in any capacity. And he's absolutely not going to be switching in any capacity. So, you know, all of that being said, I can see a world in which it works out, but quite frankly, Portland traded back from 11 to 16 to get Jan Hansen, and there were rumblings that Brooklyn was interested in him as well, which, you know, given that they drafted Danny Wolfe at 27, I think that might have been Jan Hansen if he was still on the board there. Maybe, although Danny I had higher on my board, and I think a lot of teams had Danny higher on their board than Jan Hansen. So, Aaron, I'm curious for your thoughts, because that was certainly the moment where the No Ceilings live stream went absolutely off the rails. And I don't think that was just a No Ceilings phenomenon. I think most people who have any sort of evaluation history of the draft were very surprised when that was the pick. It wasn't quite Yorgos Papayannis, but it was not a moment that anybody was expecting to happen there.
Definitely whiffs of Papayannis, though, although obviously Hansen goes out of the lottery. I'd like to just call this the Nikola Jokic effect. I mean, I think that it's the reality of people see flashes of his passing and his footwork. And because Jokic went so late, now what we see the value is the Blazers were able to kind of talk themselves into maybe overvaluing this player and getting him at such a high pick. I do think it's a little weird because, to your point, if Brooklyn was a threat, I don't think Brooklyn's taking him at 19. So why Portland couldn't have maybe moved a little bit further back and gotten something else. But who knows who else was looking to move and what the deals were that were out there at that point. My biggest problem with this, separate of the talent, like I had him as an early second rounder like most people did. I think all the questions you brought up, Nick, are going to be the prominent ones. How does he fit in as a modern big in the NBA, and particularly as a guy who, look, if he's somebody coming off your bench and you're using him as like kind of a change up to what you're doing, fine, but that's not where you're normally drafting somebody at 16. But the other conversation is, you just took Donovan Clingan.
Yes.
And I know that Yang is viewed as a developmental piece, so you're probably not too worried about how much playing time he's getting next year. But if you thought Clingan was your center of the future and you're willing to take him as high as you were last year, and you and I talked about him last year, I can't understand what you're doing just in terms of trying to stack these two bigs who are both going to have the challenges that they are as bigs in the modern NBA. And now you've got two of those guys. You don't really have like a what is your modern big man that you are looking to bring into that fold? It's obviously not Robert Williams. So it's just a lot of points that don't make much sense to me in terms of the entire construction of the team. For them, I don't think that they were too concerned about that where they are on kind of their own organizational arc, but I would have been.
I think they're just going to be leaning a lot on Tumani Kamara to clean up mistakes. And he's excellent at that. But man, I mean, yeah, in a vacuum, I would have still questioned the move because, again, as you mentioned, Aaron, I also had him as an early second round pick and he went at 16, which is quite a bit higher than early second round. Even in a vacuum, the pick is strange to me. Not in a vacuum when you look at the roster that Portland has. I mean, you know, Donovan Clingan doesn't quite have the scoring post-up game that Young Hansen does, but I mean, he's a good interior passer. He's a good big man passer. You know, he's not great, but are you really just drafting Young Hansen to be your offense first center in a league that has been, you know, consistently devaluing those guys outside of Nikola Jokic for literal decades now? And, you know, the other question slash principle that, you know, you brought up the Nikola Jokic principle. I think there's also the Victor Wembanyama principle, which is similar to the Shaq principle of 25 years ago, right? Of just, we need to get bigger than 7 foot guys to have any hope to contain Wembanyama. But the thing about Wembanyama is how athletic he is for how big he is, right? Young Hansen is not going to be able to keep up with him foot speed wise in any context. Like, he's going to be in a similar foot speed tier as Jokic, not as Wemby. So, yeah, I mean, again, the one part of it that I do sort of understand the principle of is, and I'm going to note one exception because there's one player who I think disqualifies what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, which is, I think at that point in the draft, if you're looking purely at 99th percentile outcomes, I think Young Hansen might have been pretty high up the list for, okay, if absolutely everything works out, what kind of player can this guy be? The flip side of that is, will he even have the avenue to do that with Donovan Clingan in town? And look, you know, we said we weren't going to discuss free agency much, and I won't bring it up other than to say that at least there's a slightly clearer room with DeAndre Ayton no longer being on the Trailblazers, which made that move.
Centers.
Yeah, no, it's like, DeAndre Ayton being on the roster made that move make even less sense. And so now that he's not there, it is slightly less confounding, but it's still confounding. I mean, it is a really, 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 really big bet. And I don't want to bet against the Portland front office because they've done a spectacular job in the draft over the past few years, but this was a real head scratcher.
So I want to just say one thing inspired by your mention of Victor, and please, in no way, get this confused that I am somehow confused that Hansen in any way resembles Victor or can rise to that level, because no one can. So, no, that's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is, it was Mike Schmitz that turned me on to Victor when he was 16 years old. And it was Mike Schmitz that went to China and scouted Hansen and was significantly responsible for him being drafted. So, the mention of Victor made me think of that. And no, it's not me saying that there's any resemblance between them.
I will say too, Nick, you made a point that I think really is kind of the undercurrent of this decision as well, is Portland has really stacked a lot of good young players at pretty much every position. So they are afforded a little bit of the freedom to take this risk, because of the fact that they have, I mean, you look at their depth and the number of players they have that are for coming into their fourth season or younger is really crazy to see. But my problem is, if we're talking about 99th percentile outcomes for bigs, I love Berenger so much more than I like Hansen as that thing piece. Now, obviously, Portland felt differently, but I don't even from that standpoint, I think there's a little bit of flaw in that process if we're talking about centers and outcome, but that's my own personal bias as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was not quite as high on Berger, but I had him quite a bit higher than Young Hansen. So, you know, there's that element of it as well. Yeah, I mean, it does make it look a little weirder in context that the Thunder took Thomas Sorber immediately before him. And clearly, given that Portland traded down, they were at least looking at taking Young Hansen at 11, right? So that would have been before both Queen and Thomas Sorber, which I thought would have been a very, very confusing choice. But yeah, I mean, Berger going immediately afterwards and Timberwolves front office jumping up and down being like, wow, he fell to us at 17. This is great. It's like, you know, it does sort of magnify the element of what exactly are they doing here. And, you know, you mentioned the trading down to make sure that Brooklyn didn't trade him, given that there was interest from Brooklyn. Given that the Wizards traded 18 to the Utah Jazz, maybe that deal was on the table and maybe that deal would have been better than the deal they struck with the Grizzlies. So I don't know. I mean, you know, this could very well be, and certainly we will not be the only people who get clipped if Young Hansen ends up being an all-star, all-NBA type player, but it's just confusing. And, you know, of the storylines of the draft, that certainly was the story that I think got the most airtime from people who were not expecting that to happen.
Yeah. So let's move on from some of the lesser favorite or least favorite things that y'all observed and go to, what are some of the positive favorite things that you observed in the draft relative to specific teams and specific draft?
Okay. I kind of already touched on it. I really like what the Hornets did in this draft. I thought, one, just because of that focus that we've, like Nick brought up, that we haven't seen from the organization. This seems to be over the last 2 years that they're really starting to find a direction for themselves. And I thought they drafted players that fit into that. Zion James went a little bit higher than I would have taken him, but I think that if you're the Hornets, there is the dual benefit of the player and the fact that he's kind of relatively a local product. So you are going to, with Knipple and Zion James, you also just get the influence of those being Duke players coming into Charlotte. San Antonio's draft is hard not to love. I mean, I was a huge Dylan Harper guy from the first moment I've seen him. I had him number two from last summer to this summer. But Carter Bryant, when you consider the need, positional need and skill set, but more importantly, what he can do from a developmental standpoint in that organization, the stuff that he needs to work on building out his kind of skill tree, he's just in the perfect situation for him. If he comes in and he's just a 3-and-D guy, we already know he can do that. But if they can really work on the elements of his game where it's his handle and everything else, and we've seen the Spurs do this with this type of player multiple times to really have the type of equity to trust that they can do that, that was like a knocked out of the park, just hand in glove, perfect fit, just they killed their first two picks in a way that I was thoroughly impressed by and got me really excited for them.
Yeah, I adored Dylan Harper in this draft. I mean, it's not a strong statement to say that he would have been the clear number one overall pick last year. So I will go a bit more into hot take territory, which is I had Dylan Harper and Cooper Flagg in the same tier for much of the season. And I really ended up... The only reason that I even considered moving off that was because Cooper Flagg was so sensational. And so I just want to shout out briefly my No Ceilings colleague, Maxwell Baumbach. When we did our draft superlatives article at No Ceilings, he wrote the sentence that I did not have the courage to write, which was, in response to the question, which team had the best overall haul of the draft? Maxwell said, Dallas Mavericks got Cooper Flagg. It really can be that simple. I mean, he is that sensational of a player, and, you know, him having the runway in Dallas, especially with Kyrie missing this season, is going to be spectacular to watch. But I mean, the only reason in my mind that I would have had those two in separate tiers was just because of how spectacular Cooper's close to the season ended up being. But Dylan Harper, outside of playing through a really awful illness that saw him lose like 15 pounds, outside of really bad games while he was clearly sick and clearly not himself, he averaged 22-5-5. And, you know, that's not only that, but his ability to put pressure on the rim is absolutely insane. I mean, he finished like 70% around the rim, which is a number you see from centers, not from guards who are one of the only two like viable offensive players on their team when everybody knows that he's going to be trying to drive to the basket on every possession. He's still finishing at rates like that. Just ridiculous. And for, you know, the Spurs to get him at two is, yeah, that's the obvious pick to make, and they made it. But getting Carter Bryant at 14 as someone who can just fill every gap for them, who a lot of the biggest knocks on Carter Bryant were, wait, why does this guy not have a bigger role? Guess where that's not going to be a problem with the San Antonio Spurs. You know, as you mentioned, Aaron, he can just do what he does best. And getting that kind of player at 14 to complement Dylan Harper at two and complement the rest of the roster they have, it's such a big win. And look, there are people who are going to question the fit with Harper and Fox and Castle, and I get it from that perspective. I was more encouraged by Harper's season as a shooter than most people. I think that's mainly because the expectations were quite low going in. And again, outside of that stretch where he was sick and clearly not himself, he shot like 37% from 3-point range. I love him in San Antonio just purely because I think that's a spot where he'll have a chance to be the best version of himself. And if the shooting fit is clunky, I'm nowhere near as concerned about that as I am elated about the possibility of, man, just imagine Dylan Harper charging to the rim with Carter Bryant and Victor Wembanyama, you know, just sort of hanging around, right? And it's like, oh, whatever space that he creates, anybody else is going to have this vacuum to attack through. And I love that. I love that fit for them. And getting Carter Bryant at 14 is a steal for what they need him to do. He's going to fill that role perfectly.
And I think with Harper, the catch and shoot numbers, which I think were kind of at 37.6%, I think at three from the 3/8, a catch and shoot player. The development, we're going to hear this a lot, but what would make a lot of sense is kind of what we saw with Jalen Brunson when he was the off-ball player in Dallas. You know, I think that you can see Dylan Harper do a lot of that, where he's going to get into your secondary offense stuff and kind of figure out and find his way. The fact that there's not going to be as much pressure on him to be the primary ball handler in all situations as he gets his feet under him. Not that I think it's going to take very long, yeah. Because I'm like you. I'm very big on him. I love him. The footwork, the competitive fire. I think that's one of the other things that people will bring up. Like, he wants the ball in the big moments, but it's just the entire makeup of that guy. He's going to be, even if he's not a superstar, he is going to be a star level player. I just don't think that there's anything short of that for him. And in that system, you know, De'Aaron Fox may end up the odd man out eventually because of it, because I think Harper ends up kind of sliding into a role and on, you know, timeline gets overused, but obviously the stuff with Wemby makes a lot of sense for them.
Another team who I thought was a clear, clear winner, Miami getting Kasper Siakoshonis at 20 is insane to me.
I love that. Love it. Love it so much.
It's, oh my goodness. I mean, you know, he was shooting 40% from three before he injured his wrist, and all of a sudden his shooting numbers fell off and people were shocked about that. And they said, oh, he's not doing great in conference play. It's like, yeah, he's not doing great in conference play because he's playing through an injury that's affecting his shooting hand. And when you remove that element of it, and, you know, let's say the 41% was a, or 40%, I think it was before he got hurt, was too high of a number. I don't care. This is a 6'6 point guard who gets into the lane, who's a incredibly crafty, gifted passer. And, you know, him going to Miami where they can insulate him defensively and just make the absolute most of his playmaking ability. I mean, look, I had Giannis at 7, right? So him going 20 is ridiculous to me. Him going 20th to that Miami team in particular, it's just, I mean, it's hard to not count them among the winners of this draft, just purely with that being, I think that was ended up being the only pick that they actually held onto on draft night. And that's just a huge, huge win for them.
I completely agree. I was a big fan of this pick. I think, you know, one of the questions with Kasper is what's he going to look like as a shooter off ball? But I think when you saw it in the little bit in Illinois, it looked good enough to me that you can really build that out. And Illinois just relied on him so much to be their primary ball handler. But now in Miami, he can be more of that combo guard with Hero or Davion Mitchell, whoever he's playing alongside. It's just a really, it's a great fit for that player in that system. And to me, I don't know that he's the best pure passer, but he's the most special passer in this in terms of reading and manipulating the defense and seeing that at the next level with that additional space and everything else that he's going to be provided. I think this is an amazing pick, amazing value at 20. I'm like you, Nick. I think I had him 7 or 8.
So, Aaron, I want to get your thoughts here because I am obviously biased, but I thought the Kings did really well in this draft. I mean, Nick Clifford is someone who I adored heading into the draft. And I think, I mean, I would have loved him for pretty much any team because with his kind of plug and play game, with the growth he showed this year as an on ball player, with his exceptional defense, with his great catch and shoot ability, with his ridiculous, ridiculous rebounding numbers for a guard, he would have fit in pretty much anywhere. But in Sacramento in particular, I mean, Keegan Murray was tasked with a whole lot of big man stuff this past season that he had not been tasked with previously. And I think he did a really heroic job, honestly, of living up to a lot of the power forward sort of expectations. But, you know, his rebounding was not great. And that was a problem for the Kings prior to that, because Harrison Barnes, as we talked about last year, had had a real fall off in terms of his defense and also in terms of his rebounding. Getting a guy who grabs almost 10 rebounds a game as a guard to complement Domantas Sabonis, to have him not be the only person who can attack the glass, is huge. And, you know, more to the point, I mean, Clifford, yeah, he's an older prospect, but that's really the only knock on him at this point, especially given the on-ball growth he had this past year. And then getting Maxime Reyneau at 42, I think, was a pretty huge pickup. It's not often that, you know, someone taken at 42 can come in and contribute relatively quickly. But with Reyneau, I mean, 20 and 10 guy in terms of just the basic box score stats, shooting potential, I don't want to go quite so far as to say that I completely buy into the shot. But, you know, he shot 34% on high volume this past year at Stanford. And he is one of those second round picks who I think can come in and contribute right away. And especially when you're talking about, you know, having to earn your way onto a roster pretty quickly as a second round pick to not get churned through, I think that made a lot of sense for the Kings to take him at 42. But again, I'm biased. And also Ray and I have already talked about him on the Kings Weekly podcast. So Aaron, I want to get your thoughts on the Kings draft.
So my feelings in terms of Nick Clifford, I love the pick. I think that the competitive fire, the kind of diverse skill set makes a lot of sense for the Kings. The questions with him in terms of the shooting, I buy that the shooting is going to be good enough. The feast or famine element is a little concerning, but once you get guys like that into kind of the NBA's developmental system where shooting is concerned, typically that tends to find kind of a more consistent level. And he shot the ball well enough in overall percentages in the last 2 years. Obviously, the concerns with him struggling as much as he did in Colorado and the numbers dropping a little bit in terms of better competition, but I don't think that's totally fair. One, players just evolve and get better as they get along. Also, when your numbers drop against better competition because you're the man and everybody is focusing everything on you, that's a completely sensible thing. I think sometimes it's a little unfair when we look at that and go, well, look at them when they played against the best teams. Well, yeah, because everybody was focusing their energy specifically on stopping Nick Clifford. You know, in terms of Maxime Reyneau, the value is there, right? Like he was a fringe first rounder for me. So I love that. My only issue is the Kings sure do love themselves some lead-footed big men. Like there's just, there's that challenge of just they keep doing this. But no matter what, I'm not going to fault it because much to your point with the highest end version, the best outcome, that Reyneau ends up being a great value here, particularly if he ends up being able to shoot it. He's a player that's very smart. So even if you're just talking about a guy, look, if you have a guy that's a good player off your bench, it's a great practice guy and you're taking him at that pick, there's no fault in that. Like that's to me, that is kind of on the whole a positive.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about that range of the draft, even just making an NBA roster and playing like two seasons is above expectations for your average, you know, middle of the second round pick. And even before, again, I'm cheating going into free agency stuff, but even before the Valanciunas trade, I think there was an avenue for Reyneau. Now there's an even wider avenue for him to potentially earn his way onto the roster. And that's a good get at 42. And I get the shooting consistency concerns with Neek. I think the point that you brought up about the defensive attention focused on him is the more important point to me personally. I mean, he's going to be the fourth option on the Kings. Even if they make a lot of trades, he's still probably going to be the fourth option on the Kings. But, you know, going back to the point that Ray brought up earlier of, you know, the copycat league trying to copy the sort of Indiana OKC kind of mold. I mean, Maxime Reyneau with the ball in his hands is better than most 7'1" dudes you're going to find anywhere in the world, right? And Nick Clifford in particular, I mean, his on-ball growth this year really, really stood out to me. Like, I had him as a sort of fringe first-round pick last year, just purely as a 3-and-D type. And then for him to take on the offensive load that he did this year, for him to be the primary playmaker after Isaiah Stevens left and, you know, not only do a solid job of being the primary playmaker, but improve his assist-to-turnover ratio, which is not something you see very often when players are tasked with a bigger offensive role. I just think it makes all the sense in the world for the Kings to have gotten him here. And the pick that they traded to get Nick Clifford is a 2027 San Antonio pick that's protected 1 through 16. If it doesn't convey, it turns into 2 second rounders. And first of all, the 2027 draft, and this is way too early. You know, the 2026 draft is way too early. But, you know, for the 2027 draft, it's generally seen as a slightly weaker class, especially, you know, with the high school players coming up that will be eligible for the 2027 draft. And the Spurs are probably going to be pretty good in 2 years, right? So getting someone like Nick Clifford now in exchange for a pick 2 years from now that at worst is going to be 7 slots higher than this pick, I think is a win for the Kings.
Yeah, so, I've got a couple honorable mentions as well, just while we're talking about these positive drafts before we move on, if that's okay, Ray?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, OKC and Thomas Sorber, another real just great pickup for them. Talking about that developmental ecosystem once again, particularly with him being able to work with Jalen Williams and Isaiah Hartenstein in terms of the things that he can do best as a passer in space and things like that. That's just it's a wonderful decision by the Thunder, who never really miss. I also liked what Orlando did in terms of fitting within what their organization does, right? Like Noah Penda is their very stereotypical long guy. I don't know how I feel about Penda in general, but he makes sense. I'm not a Jace Richardson guy, but if you are a Jace Richardson guy, pairing him where he doesn't have to play on the ball, because I don't believe he can be an NBA point guard with the concerns with his quickness, playing him with guards, one that can defend either position when you have Jalen Suggs out on the floor, but then also having Franz Wagner and Paolo Banchero be the guys that kind of generate your offense as ball handlers, you're just going to really rely on his shooting. We'll see whether or not the shooting holds up. I'm interested to find that out. But I thought within the framework of what the organization likes to do, they made really smart picks for themselves.
I'm slightly more of a Jace Richardson guy, and I adored that pick. It's like all of the weaknesses of Jace Richardson are, you know, okay, as you mentioned, the point guard stuff, but, you know, also he does compete defensively. He's also 6 foot even, so there is the size concern there. Orlando mitigates those concerns better than pretty much anybody else, and they so desperately, desperately, desperately need anybody who can shoot the basketball from 3-point range. It's like Jace Richardson is going to be insulated defensively. He's going to not be relied upon for the point guard stuff because they have Paolo, they have Franz, they have Jalen Suggs. And he's just going to be asked to go out there and do what he does best and not have to worry as much about the things that he doesn't do particularly well. I mean, that was one of the most obvious fits of player and team that I could have imagined in that draft. And so I'm very happy for both parties that he ended up there. I think that's going to work out fantastic.
So, Nick, you mentioned in passing the 2026 draft just a couple minutes ago. I'd like to close out our discussion today with a very brief look at the top of that draft. It's very, very strong, and there's a consensus top three. Let's talk very briefly about each of those, A.J. DiBonsa and Darren Peterson and Cameron Boozer, as well as asking each of you to mention who you might have that's not in the top three that you would consider at this point, and obviously that can change over the upcoming season, your sleeper.
Yes, so it is very, very early. A lot of this will change. We've seen absolutely none of the top high school players playing any college basketball because, you know, obviously they're just finishing high school, right? But it's interesting to me because both of you have seen in person the player who I have number one on my personal 2026 board, and I have not, but I've seen the other two in the top three in person. I saw them both at Portland Hoop Summit. I have Darren Peterson number one in this draft class. I think he is a special guard. I mean, Ray, you and I have talked about this, and Aaron, you said that you saw him in person, so I'm really curious to get your thoughts, but just it's the combination of his, you know, ridiculous feel for scoring, but also just the maturity and the poise that he plays with. I mean, he manages the game at a kind of level that you expect to see from a 10-year vet, and he's 18 years old, right? it's one of those things, and Ray and I have talked about this quite a bit, of something that I tend to fall a bit too much in love with in point guard prospects is guys who can change speed, guys who can manage the game, because that's the kind of thing that even some of the best NBA point guards don't figure out until they're in the NBA. And so if you figure that out before you get to the NBA, that's a huge leg up that you already have to sort of expand the rest of your game. And man, I cannot wait to see Darren Peterson. Hopefully I get a chance to see him in person before next year's cycle gets too crazy. But he's the guy who I have number one, and he's the guy who I haven't seen in person, right? The two guys who I have seen in person are my number two and number three, and slightly out of order from, I think, what consensus is on that front. I have Cam Boozer second overall, and he is the one thing that stood out to me most at Portland Hoop Summit is this dude has the body of a 25-year-old, and he's 18. I mean, he's 6'10", he's built, but more than that, he just, I could not get Paolo Banchero out of my head when seeing him at Portland Hoop Summit. I mean, his combination of size and passing feel, ability to run the game, ability to crash the glass, his, you know, ability as a mobile defensive big. He's not center size, which I think, you know, is totally fine, because as long as he has a 7-footer alongside him, he's going to make all the interior passes. He's going to crash the glass at a high enough level, and his finishing is incredible. He's someone who, again, I would have loved to see Darren Peterson and Hoop Summit just to see the two of them go at it. And then number three, I have AJ DeBonsa, who was not quite as impressive to me at Portland Hoop Summit. But I mean, when you're 6'9 and you can score at all three levels like AJ DeBonsa can, you're going to have fans. You're going to have fans around the league. You're going to have fans in college basketball. There are going to be people who are completely bought into AJ DeBonsa. And I get it. I really like him as a prospect. I think the other two are superlative, and AJ is not quite in that same sort of tier for me as Darren Peterson and Cam Boozer, who, I mean, I think either of those two guys could compete for number one overall pick in basically any draft outside of the Wemby draft.
You know, with Peterson, seeing him live, I'm excited for when you do, because the way he just pops out as an athlete, and there's a certain thing, and I'm sure everybody here knows it, when you see a guy on the floor, you just immediately go, that's an NBA player. Like, yeah. The way that he moves on the floor, 10 seconds in, you know he's an NBA player. He gives real hard Dwayne Wade vibes for me, particularly in the way that he impacts the game defensively. He is going to come in and be a guy that's going to be a great shot blocker from that position. And also just the fact that he plays on and off ball, just that point guard, shooting guard combination. It's hard not to love everything about him. He's locked in. He's very intense. I haven't seen Boozer as much. My biggest concern with Boozer is just what happens. Is the athleticism continue to grow, or does he kind of cap out? Because I do think there's a little bit of limitations there. I don't know that that's necessarily going to matter as long as he can shoot the ball, because of his size and his strength. It probably won't be like the differentiating factor of how good of a player he is. But that shot, I think, hinges upon some of that. DeBonsa is another guy. You see him, and the way that he moves for his size is awesome, but the lack of engagement concerns me. There's just times where you don't feel him nearly enough, and that doesn't make sense for a player that's that talented. Sometimes guys are disinterested because of the level of talent they're playing against. I don't personally love that. I'm a coach's son, so again, there's an ingrained bias for me where I want to see guys giving their full effort all the time. It may not be fair to him, but that was something that caught my eye. That's just something that I'll be watching, and does feel like a level that differentiates him for me as a prospect at the next level as right now from those other two guys. I feel more comfortable with those other two as of right now versus DeBonsa. But I know that that's not necessarily, you know, that's obviously not the overarching, you know, thought by most people.
Well, those are the three that are the consensus at the top at the moment, and it's reasonable to expect they'll stay there, but we'll see. I'd like to also ask you who your sleeper is. And again, it doesn't have to be you think they're number four. Just ignore rankings. Just who's your sleeper for a standout that you think will be more prominent than people are talking about now?
Well, you said they don't have to be number four, but because the guy I have at number four is very far from consensus at number four, I'm going to go with him here. Tunde Yusufu was the exact opposite of AJ DeBonta at Portland Hoop Summit, because the problem that you brought up with AJ DeBonta was the problem that I had, and Tunde could not have been more different. I mean, first of all, he is, you know, he and Cam Boozer both stood out as, okay, this is an NBA guy already, just purely in terms of the frame, in terms of the athleticism. I mean, Tunde was getting compared to Anthony Edwards at Hoop Summit, which the shot needs to come around for him to reach that level. But Anthony Edwards was not exactly a shooter when he was, you know, taken out of Georgia. So I think there's a real possibility for that to turn around. I don't want to speak too much on the character front just because, you know, I only had the opportunity to, you know, be around Tunde for a few days, but he blew everybody away at the press conference following Portland Hoop Summit. And look, that's a lot to hinge on in terms of, you know, buying into off-court stuff and character stuff. But just hearing him talk about the relationships that he formed on the team, world team, you know, hearing him talk about how important it is for him to represent his nation of Benin in the NBA, it's just, it would be hard for me to have been more impressed by someone in a press conference setting than I was with Tunde Yusufu. And that is not the reason that I have him at number four. I have him at number four because he's a spectacular athlete. The effort level is always there. He's just an absolute bull in a china shop when he's charging towards the basket, and he is often charging towards the basket. I adore Tunde Yusufu as a prospect, and I will be campaigning for him pretty hard if he has anything close to a reasonable season at Baylor.
I wish that I had asked earlier who you were going to say, because Tunde was going to be my answer as well.
Yes.
Because everything you said, I mean, that he's had a man's body since he was a sophomore. There's a competitive fire again that we really like. So I'll talk about somebody who I don't think is a sleeper, but just somebody who I think is going to be interesting to watch in terms of their movement possibly up if they can kind of get it. And that's Malik Thomas. I don't personally love Malik Thomas, but this is a guy who, as a guard, is a tough shot maker. And in the occasional times that he wants to, I've seen him flash point guard skills that are actually quite impressive. I don't know that I buy that he's going to ever buy into that, because he's definitely a hucker. But, and the fact that he's going to Arkansas is not the system I would have loved for his development, kind of from a personality and a player standpoint. But this is a guy that I'm going to be watching, because I can easily see a team, you know, selling themselves on what he can be because of the quickness, the ability to get his shot off kind of at any point. He can get into the teeth when he wants to. He's lower on most people's board than I think where he's going to finish. I'm not saying that he's going to end up necessarily a lottery pick, but I would not be surprised if somebody kind of jumps and takes him higher than I would personally. So he's a guy that I expect to see some significant movement from, because I think he'll probably have, obviously, the you know, he's going to be competing with Boogie Flan there, but I think he's going to have a big year in Arkansas, at least numbers wise.
Yeah, Boogie is transferring to Florida, so I was worried about that too before the Boogie transfer. Yeah. But there is still DJ Wagner in the building.
Yes, that's
unless
fair.
He transferred but, too. Did he transfer too? He might have. Who knows? The college transfer portal. Everybody's transferred.
Yeah, I didn't realize that about Boogie. I must have missed that. But So that only buttresses my point, I think. And for whatever DJ is, I think Malik Thomas would come in and steal those minutes and some of that because of some of the limitations with what DJ's game is personally. But
I mean, you know, to DJ's credit, he did let Adufiero take the ball a lot this past year. I was not expecting Adufiero to be the leading scorer on that Arkansas team. And that at least does speak positively to DJ as not being quite as egregious of a chucker as I thought he could have been.
Yeah. Now, Malik will be that egregious chucker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's no question there.
Well, I think that wraps it up, unless there's anything that either one of you want to add. I know, speaking for me, I learned a lot today, and I hope everybody else did. And I want to say to everyone, thanks for listening.
No, I'm just glad that Aaron likes Tunde as much as I do, because I was worried that I would come off completely crazy. And instead, I feel like I had support here. So thank you for that, Aaron.
No, 100%. As soon as you, it was funny because I'm like, is he going to say Tunde? And as soon as you said, I was like, oh, well, all right. Yes. Nope. You're of like mine there, my friend.
Fantastic. All right. Well, that is going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoyed the show, please be sure to subscribe to both the Unrestricted Area podcast and the No Ceilings NBA podcast, and be sure to give both of those podcasts a rating and or a review. If you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of this podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Blue Sky, NBA Johnson, or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. You can find Ray on social media, on Twitter at Ray LeBove, on Blue Sky at Ray Ray L, and of course, Basketball Intelligence at Ticket Rules. And Aaron, I do not know your handle off the top of my head, but if you want to state that now, go for it.
The easiest way to find me is on Threads, Aaron _ Bullwinkle. That's the place that I'm going to be most active on out in the space.
There we go. And that will do it for us today. Thank you all so much for listening.
Thanks, everyone.